Hello and welcome to The Curator on Monaco Radio with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. In the next 60 minutes, I will bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from the past week of coverage on Monaco Radio. This week, we pay tribute to music legend Tina Turner.
The Tina Turner story is one, on paper at least, of a journey from torment to fairy tale.
Plus, we speak with graphic designer Neville Brody.
Graphic design is about how you present an idea, and that idea can be received in very different ways if you treat it very differently.
All that and much more in the next hour here on The Curator with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And we start the show with someone who is simply the best. We're talking here about music legend Tina Turner, who sadly passed away this week, aged 83. Of course, we had a nice little tribute to her, and then the views from our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, who was almost Tina's neighbor.
The Tina Turner story is one, on paper at least, of a journey from torment to fairy tale, with a Swiss chateau boasting an uninterrupted view of Lake Zurich, shopping, gardening, and decades of bliss with her German husband. But it was lengthily and publicly fought for. Anna May Bullock, as she was named, was born on November the 26th, 1939, in Nutbush, 50 miles from Memphis. Her father was a farmer. The whole family grew cotton. Her parents, she remembered, were always fighting. Then one day, her mother left, fleeing the abuse. Her father vanished soon after, leaving Turner and her two sisters with their grandmother. Turner was brought up singing spiritual songs in church. Already she loved glamour, but couldn't envisage how a young girl from Memphis could match the models she saw in Vogue. But, she thought, the world, that's where I want to go. In 1957, she met Ike Turner. He was performing in St. Louis. She was transfixed by his guitar playing. She asked and asked and asked to sing. Ike eventually agreed. So on weekdays, Tina went to school, and at weekends, she sang on stage with him. But Ike was already unhappy that he was writing songs for artists who would do well and then leave. So Tina promised she wouldn't leave him. And in those days, she said, a promise was a promise. Anna May became Tina Turner, and as one commentator put it, Ike knew Tina was the gold mine.
Yes, Tina. Honey, that was my plan from the very beginning.
In an era of crisp, suave soul from the likes of the Supremes of the Temptations, the Ike and Tina Turner review burst onto the scene with a sexy, energetic swagger. And Ike controlled everything. They performed relentlessly, four times a night. On stage, Tina and her backing singers wouldn't know what song was coming next until Ike played its first chord. When I was a little girl, in 1966 came River Deep Mountain High, produced by Phil Spector. And for the first time, Ike wasn't needed. Tina said she felt like a bird that gets out of her cage. The song was a hit in Europe, but it bombed in the US. Between 1962 and 1976, Ike and Tina Turner lived in Los Angeles with their children, Craig, Tina's son from her relationship with Raymond Hill, a saxophonist, Ike's two sons from a previous relationship, and Ronnie, the son Ike and Tina had together. Tina and Ike were on the road for 8 months of the year. Tina was pregnant with their son Ronnie when Ike first hit her. She called it the beginning of the torture. The abuse was never spoken about in public, despite its intensity behind closed doors. Her unhappiness was such, she tried to commit suicide. She left after a final assault in a car in Dallas, fleeing across a freeway with just 76 cents on her.
Well, it was very difficult and dangerous because Ike was a violent person. And at that point, he was on drugs, very insecure. And I had no money. I had no place to go. But I just took a chance. I said, the way out is through the door. I just left the hotel, went out the kitchen way and down to the freeway, actually.
Turner said she found her courage after converting to Buddhism. a faith she'd keep for the rest of her life. Her divorce lost her everything, except for her name. And it was the name she used to pull from the shadow of her former life. Still, Tina Turner struggled to be seen as separate from Ike. But in 1981, Turner talked publicly for the first time about the abuse. And suddenly, the whole world was rooting for her.
I'm basically an up person. Even in my worst moments there, I still found time to laugh and loud. It's my nature. I forgave Ike when I left him. So what he did was damage to himself, you see.
But it was only when she permanently left the United States that Turner blossomed. In 1984, she recorded a song she hated and at first refused to record. But What's Love Got to Do with It and the subsequent album Private Dancer made her a superstar. Critics called it her comeback record. Turner disagreed. This, age 45, was her debut. In the 80s, the wigs grew bigger and the skirts shorter. At 50, she was playing stadiums. There were acting roles, such as Mad Max the Thunderdome and the James Bond theme Goldeneye.
See reflections on the water.
But people still asked about Ike. So she published her autobiography, hoping it would tell her story once and for all. The book just made it bigger, as did a biopic, Turner making it clear that talking about her past only aggravated the trauma.
People won't leave it alone. I'm constantly reminded. It's been nearly 20 years.
But it made her a feminist hero. In 1985, Turner may have been the biggest pop star in the world, but she said she'd never been loved in her life. Soon after, though, when a young EMI executive, Erwin Bach, was sent to pick her up from Dusseldorf Airport, all that changed.
I really needed love. I just needed to love a person. So I walked through the airport, and as I got to the door, this really handsome young man stepped out from behind a column, and he had his arms out, and he said, hello. So what first got me, I stepped back two steps because I didn't know who he was. And my heart was boop, boop already. My hands were wet. And I thought, oh, my God, this is love at first sight.
She famously made the first move. And their love endured, even to the point where when her kidneys failed in 2016, he donated one of his to her. She renounced her US citizenship and the couple settled near to Zurich. Turner performed well into her 60s, but in 2019 she told the New York Times that while on Tina, her 50th anniversary tour, she'd had enough and was simply fantasising about redecorating her house. I was just tired of singing and making everybody happy, she said. So she retired. Tragedy still touched Turner in her later years, however. 3 weeks after her wedding, she suffered a stroke, and her firstborn son, Craig, killed himself in 2018. Ronnie, the son she had with Ike, died in 2022 from cancer.
I endured hardship all the way. My legacy is that I stayed on course from the beginning to the end because I believed in something inside of me.
The voice, hair and the courage will continue in the future as Tina, the Tina Turner musical, continues to pack theatres worldwide. Tina Turner described the show as poison that turned to medicine, recounting the life of a girl from a cotton field who pulled herself above.
For Monocle Radio, I'm Emma Nelson.
Well, as we know, Tina Turner died in a village just outside Zurich, and it is the same village that our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, lives in. Tyler, welcome to the show. Tell me, why did she choose to live in this place?
Good morning, Georgina. Well, I think there are a variety of reasons, apart from it's an idyllic little dwarf, a little village down the lake from Zurich. I think there are also maybe some more pragmatic aspects to it as well. It is, you wouldn't call it a tax haven, but it certainly has some tax upsides living there. And of course, you have to think about someone who has amassed an enormous fortune, of course, from royalties, from performances. I mean, looking at this entire legacy, but also... And I actually go back to, you know, many years ago when I met Tina Turner as well. She just, and this is before I was here, she talked about this, you know, really remarkable setting, this almost idyllic life she had on the lake. She was able to jump in her convertible with Ervin. They were able to then drive down to Cap d'Antibes to their house in the south of France. This wonderful life of driving through the Alps, etc. And it really just, you know, sounded incredibly picture postcard. And there was a certain component, I think, that she found when she moved to Europe, when she moved to Switzerland, that she could just get on with her life here. That life was very, very private.
Mm. And was she part of the community at all?
Well, interesting question, and actually I referenced this in my column 2 weeks ago. In the village of Küsnacht, she's, you know, famous, and a little bit of local legend as well, that, you know, that she, you know, pays for the Christmas lights in town. Now, whether that's a direct check or if it's just because of her tax contribution, that is sort of one story. But one of the amazing things, Georgina, as well, is that for a very, very tiny, tiny village, Küsnacht has kind of a remarkable rescue boat, a rescue boat that probably is more fit for the U.S. Coast Guard than for certainly a small village on a not very big lake in the middle of Europe in a landlocked country. And this rescue boat is called Tina as well. So, of course, you know, has raised questions that did she also write a check or at least through her tax contributions also made sure that that the town has an incredible rescue craft.
Mm-hmm. Now, she talked in that lovely obituary we just heard from Emma about how people just wouldn't leave the subject of her marital abuse alone. And indeed, that does seem to be the focus that a lot of the coverage of her death has taken.
It has. And I think this is what she wanted to, not away, get away from. But I think that this, you know, this moving to Europe, her life with Ervin was a bit of a reset. And of course, in many interviews, of course, the recent sort of high profile interview she did with the BBC as a real sit down piece, you could sense that, you could feel that that she was, you know, not that she was certainly anonymous. And I think what you see here this morning, I mean, there's an incredible outpouring in Switzerland. Of course, many famous people living in this country. Not a lot of hugely globally famous people living in Zurich. So I think there's also the sense of loss as well, that here is, you know, a local icon, you know, albeit someone who, you know, gained their Swiss citizenship. And an interesting story around that as well, that she didn't even get her citizenship on the first round, which is kind of quite remarkable, that she had to pass her German test. But this notion that, you know, she also gave it her all to be part of the community and to just get on with it, and probably could live a life which would have been very different than if she'd been in Los Angeles or if she'd maybe been in the UK or anywhere else.
Mm. Tyler, what's your personal relationship with her, and what does she mean to you through her works, but within the community, but also within her music?
Well, certainly, I think there is this sense of someone who has made an extraordinary contribution to popular culture. That's one thing. But I've really sort of enjoyed all of these whispers and stories about, of course, the role, as we were saying, that she played within the village of Küsnacht. I think also, you know, what it means, Georgina, when someone touches down in a place and they really become a bit of, you know, a marker. They become, you know, more than a global legend. They become a local legend as well. And I think this is something which people are trying to probably come to grips with today. What, you know, what is this going to mean? And of course, when we flipped on the radio this morning, there's a full sort of Tina Turner, you know, tribute on Energy Radio, all of her songs on heavy repeat, the mayor, of course, talking about her legacy, etc. So it's this interweaving, someone who's on a global stage. And of course, you know, Georgina, you've been to Küsnacht as well. You know the stretch of Zurich. It's so tiny and so small. And then yet at the same time, here you had someone who's living a very, very private life. But of course, at the same time, it's someone who's completely larger than life.
And this week on the Concierge, Monaco's travel show, it was a bit of a Japan special. We have Kyoto-based writer and editor Danielle Dimitriou. She spoke to Katrina Ui, general manager of the Shinmonzen Hotel in the city's Higashiyama district.
This time last year, you had only just officially opened. Was it the beginning of April that you officially opened?
Correct.
I understand you opened very briefly for two nights in April 2020, and then you were obviously forced, like many hotels, to close and then reopened again with a soft opening in December 2021 and then officially opened April 2022.
Yes.
So what was that like, that whole process? And what was it like opening kind of mid-pandemic?
The whole process to us was... It's actually a good timing when we started to open. The reason is we have to restart the project again. The partial construction that was pending, in addition to just setting up everything from scratch. So it really gave us the time to not only prepare the hardware of the hotel, but also the heart, which is the recruitment, to build a team, in addition to reach out to the community. And then we were fortunate enough because they have dedicated some time for us. Maybe because it's also pandemic, so they really had that time to give us and then to get to know each other and how to work together. So it was a really good timing for us. In addition, it was also good that we were able to open the doors to the locals first. And we had guests from not only Kyoto, but also coming from different parts of Japan. It was a really good start, actually.
You've just opened one of the final pieces in the jigsaw puzzle here, which is your beautiful new restaurant by Jean-Georges. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about the new restaurant space?
Yeah, so Jean-Georges at the Shinmonzen, it just opened on the 15th of March. It's Chef Jean-Georges' second restaurant in Japan. His 67th restaurant globally. It's a beautiful space, intimate space of 36 covers. And we feature Jean-Georges cuisine, showcasing local and seasonal ingredients of Kyoto and Japan. The space is designed by Miss Stephanie Goto. So she's an architect and also designer based in New York. She previously worked with Mr. Tadao Ando, which is the world-renowned architect who we're lucky enough to work with the hotel. So she designed the space very much inspired by nature and then also Kyoto in general.
Can you just share a little bit about the atmosphere of the Shinmonzen and what guests or visitors could expect when they come and visit?
So the Shinmonzen, so we are a hidden gem of Kyoto. We're located on the Street of the Artists. We are surrounded by art galleries and also antique shops, which made us inspired of creating what we have. So the exterior design of the hotel, actually Mr. Ando's inspiration is to really respect the community and then respect Kyoto. So therefore, when you see the exterior for the first time, you would have no idea that it's a hotel because there's no signage. It's just a noren with an S. Unless, you know, it's the Shinmonzen, you would not have a clue it's a hotel. We are very much lucky to be right next to Shirakawa River. So even though we're in the middle of Kyoto, we're in the city center, pretty much in the Gion area, you feel this tranquility and serenity because we're right next to the river. And inside the Shinmonzen, from the outside, you will feel you're in a traditional architecture. But when you walk into the Shinmonzen the whole way, then you will feel you're now walking into a different world.
I feel like Kyoto, like a number of places around the world, has undergone something of a kind of creative renaissance during the pandemic. There's a lot happening here in terms of young creatives, both here and people moving here. And can you feel that in terms of the people who are coming and staying here at the Shinmonzen?
Yes, I totally can feel it, especially because we are very much rooted in arts. We also attract guests who appreciate arts like we do. And what they will discover here in Kyoto is something actually they did not expect, from contemporary arts to antiques shopping to just learning the crafts culture of Kyoto in general is something I think they did not expect how deep it is. So being here and then witnessing young artists as well as established artists in Kyoto, it's a dream, really, for guests who appreciate this art culture.
In terms of what guests have to look forward to at the Shinwonsen moving forward, can you share a little bit about what your plans are?
Plans for the Shinwonsen, of course, our goal is always to elevate the experience that we offer, something that you could not find in another accommodation we would like you to experience here. And then in addition to the opening of the restaurant this year, we will also open a patisserie soon, designed by Mr. Ogata.
Yes, Shinichiro Ogata from Simplicity.
Yes, correct, which is very, very exciting. So we'll keep you posted.
You are listening to The Curator, here with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Time now for Tall Stories. Petri Burtsov takes us to one of Alvar Aalto's most famous buildings, a modernist demonstration of what mass housing was missing at the time.
Perched on top of a hill surrounded by coniferous forests of western Finland stands Villa Mairea. Its facade is a combination of white stone and organic wooden forms, which make it both stand out from but also blend in with its lush surroundings. Villa Mairea was designed by the famed Finnish architect Alvar Aalto and is considered a career-defining work for one of the world's most celebrated modernist architects. The canon of Aalto's work consists of public buildings where his creative vision can be said to have been constrained both by budgets as well as the stringent requirements for public buildings. Villa Mairea, which Aalto built for his friends, the wealthy industrialist couple Harry Gulliksen and Maire Gulliksen ne Ahlström, on the other hand, is the purest manifestation of Aalto's architectural philosophy and vernacular. In designing Villa Mairea, Aalto was given an almost unlimited budget and more creative freedom than he was used to. This resulted in new forms and innovations that would have a major impact on Aalto's style in the years to come, and therefore also the Finnish urban landscape. Today, Villa Mairea is in private use by the Ahlström family. Here is Niklas Ahlström explaining how the building came to life.
The family wanted Aalto to sort of consider it as an experimental house, which gave him a lot of free rein to use a lot of his ideas in bringing in the natural world into the space. So the building itself is surrounded by beautiful pine forests, and Aalto designed, for example, the pillars of the staircase to mimic the pine forest, which is located outside of the building. Aalto was by far both a humanist architect and brought nature into the building and functionalism. And I think all of these are highlighted in the building itself through the Japanese-inspired architecture that is evident in the garden and the entrance to the actual building itself. These are sort of instrumental in what they wish to accomplish with the construction of the villa itself.
For Aalto, Villa Mairea marked a shift from clear-cut functionalism that had propelled him into international stardom to a more organic form of modernism, and one that was rooted strongly in Finnish tradition and nature. The building's design is used to blur the boundaries between the outside world and the inside of the structure. Its large windows and ample use of wood such as teak and pine, and its undulating free-flowing shape stand in a stark contrast to the clean lines and the rational spatial choices of Scandinavian functionalism. The interiors were largely designed by Aalto's wife Aino and continue in the same vein. Pillars made of wood resemble the pine forests that envelop the building, and the shapes and textures are used to create a harmonious ambience. In fact, Villa Mairea was Aalto's thinly veiled mockery of the rigid architecture of his time, architecture that he believed lacked humanity and artistic expressions. Villa Mairea was to him as much a work of art as it was mere architecture. Such is the building's influence on both Aalto's later work, as well as the Finnish architecture in the 20th century, that many of the elements and styles that Aalto had toyed with found their way into the mainstream and as such shaped the built environment in Finland for decades to come.
They really saw Mairea as an experiment to use these ideas in mass housing. Aalto maybe felt that housing lacked individual touches that often made buildings very impersonal. The Villa Maria is more modern in that sense, as it emphasizes function above perhaps a certain ideology. It really was a shift between functionalism into more of an organic modernist style of architecture, which, as evident in the villa itself, it really fuses Finnish and Japanese cultures and architectural styles and elements that you can see from everything from the entrance hall to the beautiful gardens around the building. And I think that really represents Aalto's striving to connect the external natural world to the built environment. I mean, this is also evident in the urban plans of Seinäjoki and Rovaniemi, for example. Aalto was a functionalist that highly valued human-centric design. This is evident in everything from small door handles to window handles at the Villa Maria, to the city plans and different designs that he created throughout his lifetime. Closeness of nature was a very important part of Aalto's architecture, and he brought that to all of his buildings, and it still has a profound impact on Finnish architecture to this day. I think bringing this nature and the play of light into spaces really set him apart from other modernist architects of that era.
21st century architects could learn a thing or two about Villa Maria's human-centric and non-conformist approach when designing both private homes as well as public buildings for our cities. One size fits all is almost never the correct way to design, and people like their built environment to surprise and to stoke their artistic senses.
And for food neighborhoods this week, that's a fun one. It's my neighborhood. We join Jeremy Lee, chef patron of Quo Vadis, on a bustling tour of his favorite cafes, delis, and restaurants in the London neighborhood of Soho.
Morning, Jeremy Lee of Quo Vadis in Soho. And here we are in Dean Street outside the venerable great pile of bricks that has stood here for 100 years and seen every bit of change you could possibly imagine in a quarter of London that has delighted and made great joy in changing with the times. And I'm here with the great pleasure and honour of going wandering through the streets of Soho to see all the lovely things that are still to be had in this marvellous quarter of town. So here we are on this charming little spot, which is Lexington Street, in what has become latterly known as West Soho, because you must always change the neighbourhoods, apparently, in this modern time we find ourselves. And just opposite is Brindisi, who we love, old stalwarts and originators of bringing the great Spanish revolution to this country. And then coming down this bow, Taiwanese wonders, all agog on little gorgeous buns and other delicious bowls and treats. And then besides that is Rita's, who are equally amazing, and then Mildred's. But opposite, really, what's very special on Lexington is the legendary Andrew Edmonds, who are one of the great old stalwart restaurants of Soho. And sadly, the eponymous one sadly passed away last year. And so we are all flying the flag for this darling to keep going in honour of one of the greats of Soho, who would always be found outside snipping flowers to put in vases that always brighten the tables every day, and a menu that changes every day, and food that always delighted and was seasonal and precious way before anyone even knew how to spell seasonal, you know. So they are very special. So it's a lovely little corner of Soho, this, that I feel that I'm very attached to and very fond of. And look, there you can see the flowers on the table, and it truly is one of the most charming dining rooms in Soho, and romantic, and the candlelight twinkles in the windows, and it is really quite irresistible. But you always want to try and get a table upstairs if you can. But I never said that and was never here, otherwise I'll get into terrible trouble. But there she blows, lovely as ever. And here we are on Berwick Street Market, which used to be one nose to tail, end to end, stockings and garters and corsets and all sorts of stuff. And look, there's our coffee darlings at Flat White. Morning, beauties. Don't you look bonny, lovely as anything? We'll be back shortly for a Flat White. This is it's the best coffee shop in Soho. So Berwick Street Market is one of the oldest markets in London. And Soho's got an ancient, ancient history of its, in its own right.
Morning.
This was a thriving community, cheek by jowl with prostitutes and ne'er-do-wells. But there was a huge Italian community, a French community, a Jewish community. It was a real brilliant, diverse mix of folk all coming together. The market was a hub of that, with all sorts of stalls selling all manner of things, from fruit and veg to stockings and garters and everything anyone would need to, you know, jolly along their lives. Pots and pans and everything. It was really remarkable. And there really aren't many markets like that left at all now. And Berwick Street, I mean, it's so smart now, and mostly it's stalls for ready-made foods that you can buy, you know, for a cheap eat at lunchtime. But there's the odd little bit of fruit and veg and flour, but it's a shadow of what it once was. But it's very, you know, it's hats off to the intrepid traders still doing their thing and flying the flag for it, because markets define a community like nothing else, and we need them very much. Like we need comic shops, like our dear Josh's one here, which we love very, very, very much as well. And I like the fact you can buy a bag of tomatoes and a comic simultaneously. It's very nice. And here we are on Greens Court, that takes out onto Brewer Street, which is a massive thoroughfare that runs parallel to Beak Street out to Regent Street. But on the corner here is one of the oldest Italian shops still remaining in Soho, Lina Stores, who have been fantastically clever and brilliant in keeping abreast of modern times and making sure their shop's as juicy as the day is long. And it's always a joy, and it's always very pretty, very colourful, with excellent pasta and cheese and salumi and coffee pots, the beans of which you can buy, of course, here, or the Algerian coffee stores, which we'll come to in good time. And then we come out onto Brewer Street, and Lord, this used to be home to so many kitchen shops and fishmongers and butchers, all of which have gone, and only the odd facade remains, really, such as this one at Randall and Oban, which was a wonderful game dealer once upon a time and fishmonger, but it's now a brilliant shellfish and seafood restaurant, and very, very good, you know, and very charming, and harks back to another and more, a gentler time, shall we say, than the one we inhabit now. So we're just coming up Wardour Street, which, in, you know, splits Soho right in half, coming into Old Compton Street, home of what remains of the once great huge food community that thrived in Soho. And first port of call is Jerry's, of course. Every bottle known to man, of every spirit imaginable, for every form and shape booze can take, really, and it is remarkable and brilliant, and we love it very much. And if in doubt, go to Jerry's, we say. They'll have it. And right opposite is Camisa, which are also going under a massive renovation, because they were very seriously threatened and got told in no uncertain terms, darling, if you want to be supported, the sandwiches must get better. The home of wonderful coffee and tea and tomatoes and tinned things, and, you know, just a great Italian deli doing fantastic stuff, and very cherished and very treasured. Beyond the legendary Admiral Duncan is the Algerian coffee stores, which ship tea and coffee all over the world. And in fact, during one of the lockdowns, I got a call from Dorina Allen at Ballymaloe saying, oh, Jeremy, you couldn't just nip round the corner, dear, and get me some coffee, because we can't get hold of it. Such is the grasp of your folk will do to get coffee from the Algerian coffee store. And there's the whiff in the air of it being ground. And it's very special. And just for the window alone, then there's usually a queue here, which is unusual. There isn't, actually. And on this corner of Old Compton Street that abuts Frith Street, it's one of the legendary old restaurant streets of Soho. And just up there, you've got the great Hoppers and Koya, who are incredible. Wonderful, wonderful cooking. And then just on the corner here, the best nutter in town. There's a whole shop dedicated to Portuguese nutter, which are amazing and very special. And then we wander along. But there blues, dear Maison Berto, which we're going. And I remember Michelle when she was, God, younger even than me once upon a time, who valiantly and brilliantly keeps this brilliant shop going. Wonderful cakes and scones and croissants, amazing pastries and extraordinary ham and cheese croissants. All sorts of good things.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We're back with the curator. And now we have the judge from the 2023 International Booker Prize. Monocle's Monica Lillis spoke to William Blacker, one of Britain's leading Ukrainian translators and also a judge for this year's prize.
Why do you think the International Booker Prize matters and what is so special about it?
I think it matters because it gives us a window into everything that's happening in the world of literature. And I mean in the world of literature, not just in our small world of literature. You know, I think those of us who read in English, and especially those of us in the UK, when we talk about literature, we kind of mean literature written in our language and often published in our country. But actually, there's a whole lot more happening out in the world. People are writing about different things. They're writing in different ways as well. And translation makes that available to us. You know, it makes our reading possibilities and our reading world so much larger. And the International Booker highlights the best of that. And it's a bit of a sort of guide to what's best in translated fiction. It allows us to sort of travel through literature, travel to places we don't know, travel to places we've not been, we might never go to. It allows you to enter into the culture, to listen to the conversations that people are having, to encounter the ideas that are being discussed and that are current in Japan or in Korea or in Mexico. It allows you real insight into histories that you don't know as well. You know, you often, when you read translated fiction, you'll be taken into the history of a certain country. There's so much that's uncovered by translated fiction. It's not only about, you know, writers representing the country they come from. We have books, let's say, like one of the books on the shortlist, Eva Baltazar's Boulder. That's not a book where Eva Baltazar is talking about Catalonia or Spain. She's telling a love story. People in different parts of the world write about these universal issues in different ways. And it can provide you just this sort of completely different perspective on a problem that you are very, very familiar with.
How much is translation a skill as much as writing or story writing is?
I always think that translation is very much a form of writing, and a translator is a type of writer. Obviously, it's not the same as just sitting down and writing your own novel, but you are still working with language. You're working with language, thinking about the aesthetics of it. You're working as a, you know, as an artist working with language, but you have that added complication of understanding and appreciating the original. So being a reader, being an interpreter, and then turning yourself into the producer and putting yourself in the shoes of the writer and trying to kind of recreate what they've done. Sometimes people compare translating to things like, you know, adapting a book as a movie. Some people argue that that is a type of translation. And I think that, you know, we should try and understand translation in that kind of wider sense, that it is a creative act. It's not just this kind of technical thing where you get a text and you go word for word and you translate each word.
Back to the International Booker itself, obviously you're going to be announcing your winner this evening. What are the qualities that you look for in an International Booker Prize winner?
I mean, we didn't have a sort of list of criteria that we were ticking off. We came to it very sort of open-minded, just very much hoping to see what's out there and to be open to what's coming at us. We read a lot of books. And we were just looking for the books that, first of all, just excited us, inspired us to think, inspired us to feel. But we were thinking about what the books are saying. Obviously, the message, you know, is this a book that's got something to say to us, that's something that feels important, that's something that's going to kind of, you know, widen our horizons and open up new ideas to us. But also, is it a book that's doing that in an interesting way? Is it doing something interesting with form? You know, is the narrative interesting in some way? Is the structure of the book interesting in some way? What about the language? What about the images? So, you know, all of the nuts and bolts of literature, we were, of course, paying lots of attention to that.
I wanted to ask about your work in translation from Ukrainian to English. How has that changed since the war in Ukraine started?
Over the last year, and it's been one of the sort of, you know, I don't know even if bittersweet is the right term, but since the full-scale invasion in February last year, there's been a lot of interest in Ukrainian literature. I've had lots and lots of, you know, journalists and editors and publishers and agents contact me. So, you know, it's been really a real pleasure for me to try and introduce people to all the sort of richness of contemporary Ukrainian literature. And there's more and more coming out in translation these days. So, you know, it's things are really improving on that front. And, you know, and one of the things also that has happened in Ukrainian literature, obviously since 2014, because the war started in 2014, is this new war literature. Ukrainian writers, I think, are writing about war in a really interesting, honest way, not in the kind of obvious way that, you know, people might expect. This is not literature that's all about heroics and fighting. It's very much about ordinary people's experience of the war. It's about all the kind of sides of the war that you might not think about, that might not be spoken about in the media. It's about the kind of inner psychological experience of going through war. So it's, you know, it's really, really, I think it's a kind of contribution to this great tradition of war literature that goes back, you know, all the way to Homer. I think the Ukrainians are really at the forefront of that at the moment. But, you know, as well as writing about war, they're writing in spite of war. And I see there's still so much literary life in Ukraine at the moment. I was actually there a couple of weeks ago, and I was amazed to see sort of new bookshops are opening up. There are events with authors happening, you know, on a weekly basis, completely packed out. And they're not just writing about war. Writers are writing about other things as well.
In a special interview on The Stack this week, Monocle's head of radio, Tom Edwards, spoke to legendary graphic designer Neville Brody.
It's been mad, in a way. It's been 30 years since the last publication. And I was waiting till I had enough work, and then actually waited too long and realized that I had far too much work. And in fact, this book is a distillation already of about 50% of what's been done in that time. So a lot of the process was curating and editing and going through everything. But to be honest, it's been a 5 or 6 year journey just getting this book on the table.
And what a journey it's been. And I've been fortunate enough to leaf through it and enjoy it. One of the things that I find really interesting is this idea, you know, it's your work, but it's your book. If you're the designer of the work and the designer of the book, what does that mean? Because you're, I guess, known a little bit for blurring those boundaries. Even if we go right back to the early 80s, that was kind of part of what informed your style and your approach. Does that make it easier to create something like this? Or actually, can it make it more difficult?
It actually makes it a lot more difficult, because if it was someone else's work, I probably would have put everything in a framed space on the page with a border around it, treated it very delicately, treated all the captions and the text the same, one style for headlines. But approaching it as someone presenting their own work, much as an artist would do when they're doing those artist portfolios, you have a kind of freedom, which is also a kind of challenge, to re-express that work. And that work didn't exist in printed book format before. It existed in another format as a poster or something on a screen. So what you're doing is adapting it to a book format. And as you're doing that, you're editorializing. And then that becomes something pretty scary, actually, because if you don't editorialize fully, you're not taking advantage of that opportunity. So what I had to do was rethink everything in the book and then bring another layer, which is the audience engagement, which is the drama of editorial.
I'm fascinated by this idea of how you address that audience. And I guess it's, in some ways, it's easier to understand the audience's engagement with your work when it's in a book, because you imagine it in their hands and it's tactile and they're flicking through the pages as I am doing here in the studio. How aware are you of the, you know, medium being the message, or do you have to try and stay true to your values, regardless of whether you're thinking about a phone screen or a TV screen or a 48 sheet poster or whatever it might be?
Well, the thing about graphic design is the medium is the message, and graphic design is about how you present an idea, And that idea can be received in very different ways if you treat it very differently. If you change the typeface, for instance, that message has changed completely. So presenting graphic design through graphic design becomes a kind of double challenge because you're reinterpreting everything again and finding new ways to, I guess, engage with the audience and bring new dimensions and facets to that work. So when you talk about the medium as the message, graphic design is the message in so many cases. And the message itself is something that gets distorted and reinterpreted.
And tell me a bit about the development of the digital realm, because it was really interesting. I was listening back before we spoke today to a chat you had with Tyler here in the studio, I think probably about 10 years ago, which is weird.
It feels like last century.
It does. Well, and this is the interesting point, because weirdly, some of the conversations you guys were having about the demands of digital and how it was democratizing in some ways, but it was more fragmentary in others, and the challenge that posed across the creative industries. Sounds like a conversation you could have been having yesterday. Where are we at in that process, Neville?
Well, when digital arrived, let's say 84 probably, but 1988 was where it sort of really started to gel. I know most people in the design industry rejected it. They didn't want to use the computer. They thought the computer would just come and go. It was just a tool. And no one envisaged at that time that the means of creation also became the means of distribution and the means of receiving. So now you're creating entirely within that digital space. And at the beginning, it wasn't corporatized. There were no corporations involved. Maybe Netscape at the beginning, and then obviously Apple and Microsoft in terms of building the machinery. But the space itself wasn't controlled. Okay, so the internet came from government and education and military purposes originally, but it wasn't to the point where you had social media. You had MySpace, for instance, or on Netscape, you could do your own, like, this is me, this is my mom, this is my garden. So you could do that personalized space, and that led to a certain aesthetic. But at the same time, there was an incredible freedom that I don't think we valued at that time, where we did projects like Fuse, which experimented with typographic language, where we could do very kind of off-beam, dramatic, experimental stuff in web. And now, as a process of corporations getting more and more in a controlling space, it's become far more regimented, far more like sitting in an office and just having stuff on your screen.
We're back with the curator, a highlight from our business show, The Entrepreneurs. This time we speak with Alex Head, CEO and founder of Social Pantry. She discusses her cause-focused approach to employment and how it is aiding the social reintegration of ex-offenders.
So Social Pantry, I started about 11 years ago, just very humble beginnings in my kitchen, where I was renting a little flat in Battersea. And I had been working in the hospitality industry for many years. I'd always been doing bits on the side. When I was 16, I started selling sandwiches on my bike. So it'd been a long time coming, bit of a hustle. And actually, I was working for some other entrepreneurs and we opened a pizza place, which actually didn't work out. So after closing this new opening, I'd learnt lots and, you know, knew the industry quite well. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to take this little side hustle and create a business from it. And then Social Pantry was born.
We were speaking before we actually started recording about how that pizza place experience taught you so much. And the mistakes that you've seen and made along the way as an entrepreneur have really shaped the vision you have for Social Pantry, work-life balance and employee welfare and the internal company culture. Can you give me some examples of what this looks like in practice?
So a few years ago, 3.5 years ago, actually, we sent our first emissary. We sent her off to do a stage. She was in the kitchen. So a stage is where you would go and work in somebody else's restaurant for a week. So Social Pantry pay them, but they go and work and get experience. So now at Social Pantry, when you've done a year in the kitchen, you go and do a stage. So after the first year, you go and do a stage at Silo, which is a zero waste restaurant in East London. But once you've been there a few years, Sarah went to Helsinki last year to work with a really cool zero waste restaurant over there. We're just in chats with one of my favourite restaurants in Paris. we're kind of looking at Japan. So opportunities, sky's the limit, really. But upskilling, I think, is so important. So the kitchen team have stages, also kind of going to see suppliers, so from kind of the butcher to vineyards. But also in terms of our front of house team, it's kind of their WSET courses and barista courses. So we'll always try and kind of upskill them where possible.
I think that's so important because we often hear that there are owners who are afraid of upskilling employees out of a fear of losing them. But indeed, you're realizing you want the best people on your team, and that requires taking that risk in the process of also helping them grow. On that topic, one of the ways Social Pantry sets itself apart is by collaborating with local prisons and charities to provide job opportunities to ex-offenders. How did this initiative begin?
I think it was about 8 years ago. I had my first ever prison visit next to Belmarsh. It's a YOI, so young offenders. And I went in with a charity called Key for Life, and I met a really brilliant gentleman called Ruben. And he has been my buddy and friend ever since. He just is fantastic. So when I was going in as a mentor, and I thought, oh gosh, what am I going to have in common? What am I going to chat about? And actually we bonded over giving up smoking. So, you know, we chatted away about how hard it was, and he was kind of saying, you know, that's his only release in prison is having a fag. And I was like, oh God, yeah, I know what you mean. So it was really fun. And actually we just got on really well. And it was through that charity that they then asked me to employ one of the other prison leavers, a gentleman called Suhail. And at that time I employed kind of 10 or so people. So I just sat them down. I said, hey guys, you're happy working alongside an ex-offender? And they said, sure, absolutely, which is brilliant. You know, what I think is that if the judicial system and probation say that these guys should be back in society, like, why wouldn't we offer them a job? Like, why wouldn't we? A lot of them have got transferable skills. They're really ambitious. They're clever. They're switched on. They're brilliant. I'd challenge anybody to kind of meet an ex-offender and not want to help them. And I think it's important to bear in mind that pre-going into prison, some of these guys have had a really tough start. So not condoning any of the crimes, but ultimately lots of the guys I've met have gone care home, prison to prison. But ultimately coming out is a fresh start, and they just haven't had much opportunity. So for us, once they've served their time and they come out into society, that's when we say, hey, listen, there's a paid job here. If you want it, it's yours to take. And if you don't bother. So for us, that was my attitude when I started. And actually along the way, I've met some really, really fantastic young guys, fantastic older guys that are coming out of prison. And adjusting to life on the outside, if you've been in prison for a long time, is definitely challenging. So we support in a number of ways, from kind of buying them a bus card or a bus pass, you know, doing that initial commute with them. Got a brilliant HR and culture manager, Sylvia, so she often kind of do a commute with them for the first time. And then some of them come out, some of the younger guys, you know, potentially have housing issues or don't kind of have a home, you know, to go back to. So really offering them a job is the only stable thing that they've got. Saying that, some people come out and are totally fine and hit the ground running, you've got somewhere to live and a family to go back to and are brilliant, and you know, that's all behind them. But really when they're up against it, if we've offered a job and a bit of support and a friendly coffee here and there, that actually, it really can help them, and it does change their outlook and their positivity, and it definitely changes their chances of reoffending for sure.
And finally, a fun one from Monaco on Sunday. Our host Emma Nelson spoke to Monaco's editorial director Tyler Brulé on the delights of Thai supermarkets.
Good afternoon. I'm going to spend 10 hours in the aisles of this grocery store that I'm in right now. I'm at CM Paragon, having complete supermarket space out right now, in a very good way, I have to say, though.
Oh, my goodness. I can't tell you how thrilling an international supermarket is. Which aisle are you in?
Well, I've actually just, since we went on air, I'm sort of in front of the CM South Sea Bird's Nest display at the moment, but I might drop into the assorted Thai sauces in a moment.
Okay, that's fine. What have you, is there anything we have to ask you? What are you picking up? Because there is always the Tyler's Travels question. I mean, what's coming back in the bags?
Well, lots of things are coming back in the bag. Dried garlic, which you think, actually, dried garlic, very easy to come by in Europe. Actually, not so easy to come by. And the Thais do all kinds of varieties of it. Prawn scented, you can imagine. A lot of dried mango. And then, we've sort of touched on many times, of course, Thailand is obsessed with Japan, incredibly important. Trading partner, strategically very important. Also, it has the largest Japanese community outside of Japan in Asia. It used to be Shanghai. Now there's many more Japanese in Bangkok. And so the aisles of the stores are just full of all of these things you'd normally find in Tokyo. But the Thais want to sort of, you know, push these things in a very different way. Now, of course, we know Japan has very hot summers. Just before we went on air, Emma, I sent you a photograph of basically a whole wall of cooling talc. Now, this is, I think, you know, if anyone is listening, is looking for a business opportunity as the world warms up, the Thais and the Japanese have this whole cooling world completely nailed. And so what, Emma, you're going to get, even though the studio is quite cool, there's a whole range of different brands are competing with cooling spray for your shirts. So this is not something that you put on after the wash. This is something that you would probably put on with your deodorant in the morning. You spray it all over your shirt, and as things get warm, it releases sort of a menthol cooling feeling.
Oh,
so I'm thinking this, there's going to be a big, big business in this.
This sounds like heaven. I have the photograph in front of me. May I briefly describe what you've sent me? It's effectively, I think there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 rows of cooling talcs, which range in sort of branding from something that looks like something that you'd have as a protein drink. I think that's Protex. I'm not entirely sure if it isn't a protein drink. Apologies. But then we move into the slightly more interesting snake brand for prickly heat. and then we don't just have snake brand. We go to parrot. Now just tell me, which one are you picking for me?
Oh no! Listen, you're getting the Sakura scented prickly heat snake brand. That's the one you're getting. This week they're also pushing the kelp version as well. So the great thing about also it comes in a proper sort of tin can. You know, Protex all a bit sort of plasticky, but the amazing thing is that you have these talc dispensers, and actually the brand is called the British Dispensary. That's the holding company that's churning out all of this talc as well.
Oh,
so anyway, Sakura scented for you for toasty summers ahead.
This is all a girl can dream of. Thank you, Tyler. I've got two panelists, Yasmin and Nina, who are just looking on with absolute envy. Yasmin's putting her orders in. How much space have you got, Tyler? Because I think we've got people putting orders in.
Yeah, I think I'd want
go on, Tyler.
Oh, yeah, go on, Tyler.
Sorry. Listen, you know that I do travel light, and it's a very short trip. It was two and a half days in Hong Kong. It's 2.5 days here. So it is one small case. But listen, you know, I'm sure if I go over to aisle 75, they're going to have expandable luggage as well. So it won't be a problem.
Thank you very much indeed. Can I just politely ask that you don't put my talc next to the prawn-scented dried garlic?
Now, well, no, listen, I mean, everything's overpowered in the store right now because it's durian season as well. So I'm surprised if you actually swung open the studio door, you could smell the durians, I'm sure, all the way over in London. It's quite pungent at the front of this grocery store right now.
Can I ask you, for every single check-in in the future, can you do it from a supermarket, please? This is brilliant fun.
endless array of choice and things to talk about. Trust me.
All right, tell us other stuff you want to raise. Otherwise, I'm just going to go aisle by aisle until we run out of time.
Now, well, just one observation, though. I was in Mexico City last week. I came across, we could have actually done a call-in from there because I discovered City Market in Mexico City, also fantastic grocery store chain. But you know, you're in Thailand, and we have to sort of remember as well because, you know, and there's probably a reason why the Thais, the central group, have been buying up so many department stores all over Europe. It's because they know how to do a bloody good food haul. You could argue that the European department stores are the ones who invented it, but the Thais have completely reinvented it. They've taken the best of Japan. They've certainly taken, you know, the best of Europe, and now they're running circles around everybody. I'm quite sure I probably saw, you know, at least two or three groups of they were clearly from Western grocery stores. That could have been back in aisle 62, of people taking photographs who are definitely having an eye as to what, you know, what this market is doing when it comes to retail food innovation.
And that's all we've got time for this week's edition of The Curator. The show was produced by David Stevens and presented by me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again next week, and thank you for listening.